everyone. I would like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services to order. We are going to follow the order of the agenda, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 626. And Sandy, would you let us know about this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 626 comes to this committee with you as the chief sponsor. This is a bill that's renaming the long-term care ombudsman position and the office, the long-term care ombudsman's office, to the office of and the ombudsman for vulnerable adults. It expands the duties of the office to address the expanding needs of the residents and the care facilities who have mental illness and or developmental disabilities. And that's the short summary, Madam Chair, and this is just a public hearing, so
okay.
We're good to go.
And these three first, do you think?
Yes.
Megan, do you want to go first? Okay, Megan Moyer, Lila Hendrickson, and Robert Nash. Before we start, this is a bill that's extremely important to me, and I do support this bill, there are some changes that I think that we want to make, but my written testimony is submitted, and I'm not going to read it. So,
Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union, Local 503. We represent over 55,000 workers in the state of Oregon, over 20,000 of those providing direct care for seniors, people with physical and developmental disabilities, and mental illness. And we are here today in support of Senate Bill 626, which would expand the work of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. One of the amendments that we are working on is to not use the current name in the bill. There is general consensus that that is not the name we want to use, but we are open to suggestions if people have better ideas. But the content of the bill, we are extremely supportive of. The reason why this bill is before you is because of the wonderful work of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. Currently, the office serves facilities for seniors and people with physical disabilities. Those are over 43,000 beds statewide. This program has grown to over 200 volunteers statewide who volunteer their time to go into homes and facilities. Oh, sorry. And be advocates for people in residential care. This program has been so successful that it is actually a national model. We would like to see that same success, that same energy and volunteer base, that same energy toward advocacy for others spread to residents of other types of settings who could use this level of advocacy, including adult foster homes, which SGIU represents, both adult foster homes for people with developmental disabilities and people with mental illness, as well as group homes and residential treatment homes. Why do we need this? Currently, we do not have this model of advocacy available to those populations. This model of advocacy allows eyes on in the community. It is based on an unbiased individual acting as an advocate with the permission and consent of the individual or the resident. And it has been highly successful in resolving conflicts within a residency, helping address quality concerns around care, and making sure that the rights and the interests of individuals are represented in the system. As this committee has heard in previous hearings, we are working very hard with many others to improve the role of self-determination and services for people with developmental disabilities, as well as mental health. And having an ombudsman program is one way of accomplishing that, to have a system where there are dedicated individuals who are there to assist residents in advocating on their own behalf and for their rights. We hope that this is viewed not only as an important step forward, but also as a ringing endorsement of the success of our ombudsman program and an eagerness to see this same model and this same program helping the lives of thousands of others who could benefit from this program. And I would want to thank Chairman Sanderson for her support and Senator Cruz also for his support of this bill. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Lila Hendrickson, and I work for Bethesda Lutheran Group Homes as a direct service provider. I have worked in Bethesda Group Homes for 8.5 years and have seen several problems with the DD service system. I've reported these problems, and many times I have not had success getting help. This is why I am here, asking for your support for SB 626. I'd like to share one of the worst cases where I was unable to get help for a person I provided services to. This woman, I'll call her Beth for privacy reasons, was in her 30s and has Down syndrome. She can read and write, but she's not able to talk very well, so she's unable to express herself many times. She's a social person who likes to shoot hoops and help out around the house. However, she also has a history of behavioral issues that have threatened her roommate's safety. She sometimes steals from her other roommates, steals food, steals personal mail from the mailbox. The most concerning behavior is when she attempts to forcefully feed one of her roommates that she has this time. One time she was found holding the man in a neck hold and trying to force food down his throat. This kind of behavior occurs constantly, and yet she has not been placed on a behavior management program. Staff, including myself, have written several incident reports that account for Beth's behavior. These incident reports are internally reviewed by Bethesda Lutheran and also shown to Beth's caseworker. I spoke to Beth's caseworker and asked him why, despite these unsafe behavior issues, she is not on any behavior program of any type. He told me that the higher-ups decided that because of Beth's particular kind of disability, she had the instincts of a dog and therefore wouldn't be able to learn or benefit from a behavior program. This comment shocked me so much that I attempted to file an abuse complaint within Bethesda's online abuse process. However, the online program kept kicking me out while I was trying to file the abuse claim, and so I was ultimately unsuccessful in filing it. I wish I could have gone to an independent agency with Beth's case. If there was an ombudsman program available for people with developmental disabilities, I would have called on Beth's behalf and reported these issues. Then Beth would have had an advocate to help her fight for a better support system and plan and receive the services that she so clearly needs. If SB 626 is passed, people like Beth will have an independent advocate willing to fight for what they need. Please support SB 626. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Robert Nash. My wife and I operate 3 adult foster homes for people with developmental disabilities in Central Oregon. I am here today to ask your support on Senate Bill 626. I have provided services for people with developmental disabilities for over 20 years. Some of the adults now living in my foster home were served in my home as youth. As youth, they had court-appointed special advocates, or CASA, to help advocate for them, but now as adults with developmental disabilities, they have no one to step up and advocate for them except for the providers. I'd like to share a story of one of our residents in my foster home. This resident is a young man who was told for years by the county that he could not do rodeo events. And then for reasons that we disagreed with, the county made a decision to move this young man from our foster home. In order to convince him to leave, The county promised him that he would be able to ride in the rodeos. He agreed to move and was moved to another home. Within a short period of time, this place, new placement proved to be not a good fit. He began to steal things from the home and then ran away. After about 5 months, he was moved back to our home. The whole experience was unnecessary disruption in his life and frankly was pretty traumatic. And as a result of the developmental issues, many of our residents need stability and predictability. Disruptions like these can cause needless increase in unsafe behaviors. The county was able to totally disrupt the stability of our residents' life. The resident tried to file grievances on multiple occasions. He would get on the phone with the county, and each time the county talked him out of the grievance. I feel that had there been an ombudsman available, there would have been an unbiased advocate to help him during this challenging situation. I support expanding the Oregon Ombudsman Program to meet the needs of people with developmental disabilities because people should have the same type of advocacy available to them regardless of which type of disability they have. I hope you will support Senate Bill 626. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the panel? All right. Senator Steinhardt Hayward.
First of all, Madam Chair, thank you very much for bringing this bill because I completely agree with everything that our panelists have said about expanding the definition of who's included in the groups that can be served by this ombudsman. I also agree that I don't love the idea of using vulnerable adults. I guess I'm wondering whether you think long-term care would still be applicable because these people, all the other kinds of people you've described, are receiving long-term care in one form or another. So I'm curious about your thoughts about that.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Hayward, that is one of the options. Technically, we do not call residential services for people with developmental disabilities or mental health issues long-term care. That's a term that is specific to aging and physical disabilities, although many other states do put mental health and DD under their ombudsman program, and they call it long-term care. So that's certainly an option.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, panel. With that, I'd like to call up Esther Rogers, Marcia Mason, and Edward Mason. And please proceed.
Okay. Good afternoon, Senator Moniz Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Esther Rogers, and I work for Bethesda Lutheran Communities also as a direct support professional, and I've been working there for 5 years. I'm here to ask for your support for Senate Bill 626. Senate Bill 626 would expand the long-term care of ombudsmen program to cover people with developmental disabilities and health issues. I provide in my time with Bethesda, I've seen several situations where it would have been useful to call an ombudsman. For example, on my very first day of work at a group home in Bethesda, I witnessed a coworker abuse several of the residents. She smacked one person on the head, flicked water at another person to wake them up, and encouraged another resident to hit himself in the head. I was shocked by my coworker's behavior, but knew from the recent training that I had to report it right away, and I did. Unfortunately, my report put my own job in jeopardy, and as I became an outcast among several of the more senior people I worked with, the coworker whom I reported attempted to pressure me to minimize the abuse I witnessed, and I was told that my job would be on the line if I did not tell the investigator what she wanted me to say. I was scared not only for my job, but also for the residents who were depending on me and the rest of the other staff to keep them safe and free from harm. Had an ombudsman been in place, I could have made sure that the residents had an independent agency to provide a voice and advocate for their safety. When I was coached to misrepresent the abuse that I had witnessed, I could have reported this without being fear for my job. With an ombudsman in place, the people who live in the homes where I have worked could be sure that there were people advocating for them, looking out for them, and doing so without fear of retaliation or any other consequence. Senate Bill 626 could help ensure that stories like mine are not repeated. Please support this important bill.
Thank you
for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Senator Mons Anderson and committee. My name is Marcia Mason. I live in West Lynn, Oregon, and I represent myself. I'm the parent of a mentally ill adult. She's an adult child, but she's an adult. The Senate Bill 626 is a very personal issue for me. I support Senate Bill 626. I believe that our mentally ill and developmentally disabled populations are vulnerable populations, just as vulnerable as persons in long-term care, and as such deserve to be included with this population and have an ombudsman to call on when care or treatment is questioned. In these economically trying times that our country is experiencing, it is the vulnerable population that many times lack a voice and are unable to advocate for themselves. Budgets are slashed and seemingly balanced on the backs of people without a voice, again, those who are unable to advocate for themselves. It is imperative that we protect our vulnerable populations and expand protection and representation rather than take it away or just leave well enough alone. I commend this committee for taking testimony on a bill that would do just that, expand care and protection beyond what it is today. My daughter Dana is a mentally ill adult. She is presently 26 years old and was diagnosed as mentally ill when she was 14. She has been in and out of institutions since that time. She is currently living independently, although not very successfully. I believe that if she or I had access to an ombudsman at various times in her past, she and we may have had a different outcome. Just based on her past, I can foresee a time in the future where she will need to call on an ombudsman. I hope that there will be an office and a person to respond who will be able to help her. Because vulnerable populations many times cannot advocate, nor can they speak up for themselves, it is up to us to find the ways and means to do this for them. Societies are judged on whether they take care of and protect the most vulnerable among them. It is my hope that Senate Bill 626 becomes law and that my daughter Dana, along with the many, many other vulnerable adults in the state of Oregon, have an ombudsman that they can turn to when they have the need. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you very much.
Chairwoman Senator Moniz Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Edward R. Mason, and I represent myself, parent of a mentally ill adult. I support Senate Bill 626. I believe our mentally ill and developmentally disabled population deserve to be represented by an ombudsman. This bill would expand the current title and office to include these two groups. My son Hanson lives in a residential care facility in Oregon at the present time. He has no ombudsman to voice his concern, nor do I, as a parent, have anyone I can contact over and above the county if I believe his care or well-being is compromised. There are two instances that I believe fall right into the justification of his new position in office. First, Hanson is diagnosed with schizophrenia, and it's imperative that he be on daily medication. When he arrived at this facility, he was on medication doses that were too high and left him in a very impaired state. I was not able to advocate for him by accessing his prescribing physician, nor did the facility feel they could step in on his behalf. Thus, I was left with no recourse or measures to remedy this situation. If I had an ombudsman whom I could have contacted, possibly this situation could have been remedied. Second, the facility's goal is to train the residents to be able to achieve independent living. In Hanson's case, each time he's attained independent living situation, he stops taking his medication and eventually is committed back into the state hospital. If I could advocate or have an ombudsman who could advocate for him and have him a long-term resident in this care facility, he would certainly be better off, and the state would not have to pay for his long-term care in a mental hospital. Thanks for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Thank you so much for coming. Bill Olson, Eva Repito, and Kim Turkmenoglu. I'm not sure if I got that even close. Please proceed.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Bill Olson. I represent the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities. I'll keep my statement very brief, reserve the hope that I may submit written comments at a later date.
Absolutely.
We're very supportive of the intent of this bill, and we're very pleased with the work of the Ombudsman's Office. I think their record in recruiting volunteers is something that just about every one of us envies. And those of us who have tried to recruit and manage volunteers in the past have to be pretty impressed with that record. My one concern about the bill is whether there will be the resources at the other end of the hall in the Ways and Means Committee to provide the additional resources necessary to carry out this additional scope of work. As I understand it, we're talking somewhere around 1,800 new facility or additional facilities and some 7,000 or so residents. And so that's my concern, but otherwise the intent of the bill is certainly something we would support.
Thank you so very much.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, thank you for your time today. My name is Eva Repito, and I'm representing AFSCME Council 75. We do represent some workers in group homes, and so and I spent a good portion of my day with two of our members from group home and told them about this bill, and they were really excited to hear that the ombudsman may be expanded to serve their clients as well. They feel like it's a very needed role to have advocacy for intellectually and developmentally disabled and mentally ill patients as well. So that's all I wanted to say. We're supportive. Thank you
so much.
Good afternoon, Senator. Good morning, Sanderson. My name is Kimberly Turkmenoglu. I work for Bethesda Lutheran Communities. I just have a brief story and why I want the ombudsman program to bill to pass 626. I reported three abuse in January 2012 of a gentleman. I not only reported it to the company I work for, but the state. In March of 2013, I was called to talk to the state, and they asked me questions, and I asked them why it took so long to have anything done about this. She didn't think a year was long. The state care worker called me. How long should this man have tolerated this abuse? A year is a long time to me. So an ombudsman program would have been another option. They could have went to the state for him. Somebody would have been there to advocate for him. They could have walked into the home at any time and seen it, because there's an open door policy. Somebody could check up on him, and he would not have went through his abuse for a year. So I support this bill. So the state's overworked in some cases. This way, there's someone else there to step in and voice for them.
Great. Thank you so very much. Any questions for the panel? Thank you very much. That's the last for this bill. I don't know if Mary Yeager, can you just come up real quick? I want to just ask you or tell you about or let you know how much I appreciate the work that you do with the existing ombudsman program right now.
Thank you.
Having worked with you with a long-term care facility in my district that really needed some ombudsman care because it was just needed. I won't go into the particulars, but do you have any comments regarding this particular bill, or are you neutral as you usually are?
Well, Chair Monis Anderson and committee members, as you know, we already
work with 43,000.
Your name, Mary.
Oh, Mary Yeager, for the record, state long-term care ombudsman. So right now, 25% of our funding comes from federal government. The other 75% comes from the state of Oregon. For 43,000 potential residents, we have 10¾ staff and over 200 volunteers. We could use more volunteers and more staff so that actually all of those potential residents are covered. However, as I've been sharing with my family and other colleagues in this building, 40 years ago when the long-term care ombudsman program started, it was because of abuse and neglect in long-term care facilities. So here we are 40 years later, and I don't know how we as Oregonians can deny help to other populations and other Oregonians who need help. So if this building comes up with funding, I hope you know I and my staff and the volunteers will be delighted and honored to help.
Right. Thank you very much, Senator Cruz.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm the sponsor of the bill, so obviously I support this expansion. We do need some help coming up with a different name.
Oh, you missed that part.
Oh, I did?
Oh, yeah, okay. We don't like the name.
No, don't like the name.
We do not like the name. We like ombudsman, and we're sticking with long-term care ombudsman.
Okay, okay.
Or community ombudsman.
I think, Madam Chair, it should... Community is probably better because we are doing an expansion here, and I think that more addresses.
I don't think community works anyway.
But Chairman Sanderson and committee members, that will give us, all of us in the variety of communities, some really good coffee conversation.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mary. All right. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 626 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 777. Sandy, do you want Ann Murray, Jim Gardner, and please come forward, and Lauren Sant, come forward.
Senate Bill 777, Madam Chair, modifies the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee, otherwise known as the P&T Committee, of the Oregon Health Authority meeting requirements. This has an emergency clause effective on passage. And you should have a dash one amendments with all your other meeting materials.
Yes.
Great.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Murray, and I am representing Bristol-Myers Squibb. And you have before you today Senate Bill 777, which proposes some modifications to a process that was established last session. House Bill 2100, the co-chairs in the House of the House Health Committee appointed a work group to work on the bill that was initially introduced by the Oregon Health Authority, proposed some modifications to previous legislation, and also created the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee and the Health Evidence Review Committee. And about, I don't know, 17 or 18 different interests spent about 35 hours last session coming up with the final product, House Bill 2100. What 777 does is, after 2 years now working under that system, proposes some modifications to the process, particularly by which the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee conducts its business. It does not change the authority of the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee to do what it does, and that is review and recommend drugs for the preferred drug list in the Oregon Medicaid program. The bill proposes 6 specific changes to enhance transparency of that process, the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee process. And briefly, I'll just go through those. The first, it requires the notice of the drugs to be considered by the committee for exclusion or exclusion on the Medicaid preferred drug list. Currently, the statute requires a specification of the classes to be considered. We're looking for the actual drugs that will be considered, as the name of the class doesn't necessarily always provide the notice that we think is adequate to indicate specific drugs that will be under consideration at a particular meeting. The bill requires the documents to be considered by the committee to be posted on their website. Currently, the committee is required to post background information and supporting documentation provided to committee members, and what we are asking for is clarification that the intent is to disclose any documentation that the committee is going to be considering, obviously, in the public meeting, not simply background information and supporting documentation, but any documents that would be considered by the committee in that meeting. The bill also requires a separation in the agenda from the pharmacy and therapeutics actions of the committee considerations and the drug utilization review process, so that there's two different processes going on. We'd like to see the agenda separated so that everybody has notice of exactly what is being considered at what time. And State of Washington does this already. They divide it into two, and it just provides a good framework for folks to actually be aware of what actually is going to be happening at the meeting. The dash one amendments that you have further clarify that intent. The language wasn't quite right in the original bill regarding that divided agenda, so the first part of the dash one amendments actually perfect that. The bill also requires the committee to specify on the agenda the purpose for any executive session that they might hold. There are four purposes, if you will, permissive reasons for which the committee can go into executive session. And in 777, we're simply looking for the committee to actually post on its agenda which one of those reasons they're utilizing, so that there's some information to the public as to maybe not the details of what they'll be discussing in executive session, but the subject matter. And then one of those permissible purposes for executive session now is to review confidential pricing information, and including substantial cost differences between drugs and classes, and we are not proposing a change to that. In the sense that the committee's authority to actually review that information in executive session. However, the original intent of this process was to ensure that only if the committee determined that there's no difference in safety and efficacy between drugs in a class, would they then go look at the substantial differences in cost to make their determination, but that the determination regarding comparative safety and efficacy would be made initially. And as I said, if there's no difference, if you will, then they could consider substantial differences in cost in their decision-making or in the recommendation to the department of which drugs to put on the preferred drug list. So the bill before you reinforces that intent by requiring the committee to find, prior to entering into executive session, to discuss cost, that a substantial difference in cost would be the determining factor in the committee's recommendation to include or exclude a drug on that preferred drug list. And once and if this finding is established, the committee would be considered, would be permitted to consider cost in executive session. And the bill clarifies that cost is net cost after rebates and any reimbursements that are due to the department. Finally, the bill requires committee findings to accompany the committee's recommendation to the Oregon Health Authority, and adds a few considerations to the committee recommendation section in the original or in the current statute. Excuse me. Including the bill adds the requirement that the committee actually consider the FDA-approved indications of the drugs that are being considered. It's fair to say that we assume that that goes without saying, but we're looking to have it said now, that the committee will actually consider primarily what the drug's actually approved for in its determinations. The bill reworks the requirements that are currently on, you'll find on page 3, lines 26 through 28, that the committee consider a patient's ability to access effective prescription drugs appropriate for their medical condition. Not many of us, and actually I don't think anyone on the work group was able to explain the specific language there. We understood it was to require the consideration of the impact of any committee action on patient access to medication, but the proposed changes in that section of 777 reflect what we understand to be the original intent of the, or to be the intent of the original, but perhaps vague language. As to the dash one amendments that you have before you, as I said, the first part of that amendment, lines 1 through 7, further clarify the separation of the agenda between the P&T committee process and the DUR, drug utilization review actions that the committee may be considering. And then the second part of that dash one amendment codifies anti-discrimination language modeled after that in the Federal Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, federal health care reform, which prohibits discrimination against patients based on disease or condition, quality of life, or expected length of life. We did discuss inclusion of this language last session in the work group, and OHA, Oregon Health Authority, opined that it was unnecessary to add it as it's federal law, and they're actually required to follow federal law. And after 2 years of experience with this process, we're actually seeking codification of that language to guide this committee process and the Oregon Health Authority going forward. I know Mr. Gardner will have additional comments on that specific aspect, but I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Let's hear the panel, and then we'll open up to questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I represent PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, which includes in its membership all of the principal research-based drug companies operating in the United States. I served along with Ann and a multitude of other interests on the House Bill 2100 work group, a very, very thorough process, a very substantive process that we went through. But as in any major revision to a big statute, there are things that you learn through the implementation process that you can bring back to this body to make the process a little bit better, a little function, a little smoother, and that's what this bill really is all about. It's we support fully the improvements to transparency and really just to the smooth operation of the P&T committee that we think this bill will help further. I do want to address the second part of the dash one amendment, and this does reflect very closely the language, the so-called anti-discrimination provision that is in PPACA right now. And I learned somewhat to my surprise today that there may be some concerns expressed about this codification by OHA. It'll be interesting to hear what is said there, since it is indeed a requirement of federal law. And you might ask, well, if that's the case, why do we need to codify it in state law? And the really reason is that PPACA is an immense, enormous chunk of legislation, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages long, and it's important, we believe, that the people who are responsible for administering this program have in front of them essentially a state statute that reminds them of this provision. It's an important belt and suspenders approach to ensuring that this very important policy is implemented.
Thank you. Lauren?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Sant. I'm an executive director, of the Caring Ambassadors Program in Oregon City, Oregon. We're a nonprofit. We do patient advocacy for people with long-term diseases, specifically hepatitis C and lung cancer. But I'm here today on behalf of everyone living with any type of disease in Oregon. We do fully support Oregon Senate Bill 777, including Amendment 1, which we feel is really important. While we're on the paradigm shift of changing our healthcare system, we're not there yet, and we are still an acute healthcare system. We're not a prevention-based healthcare system. And an individual should not be penalized for getting a disease. Diseases don't discriminate. Therefore, we should not discriminate against those people that are diagnosed potentially with later when treatment is not as successful. For an example, liver cancer, the fastest, most lethal growing cancer in the United States, is completely preventable. It's increasing because of undiagnosed hepatitis B and hepatitis C. And yet,
if someone is diagnosed with liver cancer and has about 2 years to live, are we not going to treat that person because they were not diagnosed early enough to prevent that liver cancer from happening? Again, I ask that we, until we change our paradigm shift and we are working in prevention and healthcare, that we not discriminate against people that are afflicted with a disease where their life expectancy may not be very long, but they certainly deserve care and treatment. I've experienced a couple of situations with the P&T committee trying to testify myself, and so CAP actually has some other things that we'd like the committee to consider when you're talking about the P&T committee, because it's broader than just access to medications. Many people don't even understand what the P&T committee is doing, and there needs to be more open process, more public comments. I recently went to one on hepatitis B. I went because no Asian group could get there because they were not notified in time, nor did they feel like they had the qualifications to testify because the language, none of the language was translated for them, so they didn't really understand. Again, it was a class of drugs being talked about, not the specific drugs. Didn't know what the impact might be of these drugs not being able to be prescribed for an infectious disease. I got there, the PT committee was out of the handout, so I didn't even know what was being discussed because that was not available to me. So again, it was very frustrating. And finally, the meetings are held in Wilsonville on a Thursday afternoon at 1 o'clock. Less than 6.8% of Clackamas County utilizes this program. These meetings really need to be held in Multnomah County or someplace where there's access so people can take advantage of webinars, get there. Their committee schedule needs to stay on time. It needs to be as written. If you do take off work and you go down there and it's supposed to be talked about at 1 o'clock and you get there at 1 o'clock and they don't talk about it until 4 o'clock, how many people can hang out? They have health care, they have child care, there's all sorts of things that happen. We really urge them to think about how can you include the community more in doing this. One of the days I went down, it literally hailed, snowed, and rained on me, and we had a rainbow. It was a beautiful day. It was a beautiful day to travel, but I have a car. If I had been trying to get to Wilsonville on a bus or some type of public transportation, it would have been impossible. So, again, I ask that the committee really open up and think about the people that they are making these decisions about. These people are not health, they don't have really high health literacy. We have to think about what are these decisions being made that's going to affect their lives. So anti-discrimination is really critical here, that we include that language and that we don't forget these people who can't speak up for themselves. The meetings are expensive to get to. We can do it inexpensively. It doesn't have to be done. The Oregon Health Authority has done a great job of having their meetings in very publicly public places that are easily accessible by public transportation. I think the P&T committee could do a better job of doing that themselves. And if they can't, they need to make sure translation is available. They need to make sure transportation services are available. If you're deciding something, for example, on hepatitis B, where, you know, 1 in 10 Asian Americans have this disease, and chronic hepatitis B is disproportionately represented in the state of Oregon, then why were none of those materials translated into Mandarin so that the population could understand them? So just my thoughts on how the P&T committee could do a better job. I love that everything is being done by the Oregon Health Authority, and really hope that we can help improve increase health and accessibility to quality health care in Oregon. And I know it's a big undertaking, but thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure everybody on the committee knows this, and I should, but I don't. Could you fill me in a little bit more on the mission of the Caring Ambassadors Program?
Sure. Our mission is to help improve the lives of those afflicted with long-term disease through advocacy, education, and support.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. Tom Burns.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Tom Burns, Director of Pharmacy Programs for the Oregon Health Authority. Senate Bill 777, as it was originally introduced, is really probably a pretty good bill. There's a few little tweaks, if you want to move it, that we want to talk about. I think the most important tweak is on page 2, lines 25, where they talk about the net cost of the drug. I couldn't agree more. I mean, that's the intent. That's what we function. That's what we do. I am nervous about the word reimbursements. I don't know what that word means when it comes to the subject of a pricing of a drug. Clearly, we look at the cost of the drug, but we pay the pharmacist and compare that with the rebate we get. But I don't know what a reimbursement is, and if the proponents want to help me understand that, we can discuss that. I do want to, however, talk about the Dash 1 amendments. Lines 1 through 7 of the Dash 1s are fine, no problems. We are very nervous about the Clause 7, lines 9 through 13. This was something that was discussed in the work group. We did spend a lot of time about this, talking about this. And we said, quite frankly, that yes, the ACA does have language similar to this. Yes, the Oregon Health Authority is a function of a government that must serve under the what the ACA says. And yes, we intend to follow the ACA. Our nervousness comes when we put something like this in state law and were to see the ACA get changed, and then Oregon is out of the compliance with federal law, and we'd have to come back and remember to make the changes in order to match what federal law says. We're also a little nervous about the terms notwithstanding any other provision of law. That's a pretty broad term, and in fact, I have on numerous occasions asked Ledge Council to put those words in and have been told they don't put them in. So I'm not quite sure what it is. Our concern is that this section sits within the middle of the entire Medicaid program. And the clause, notwithstanding any other provision of law, could allow the program, these words, to expand beyond where maybe they wanted to expand. I think that if this committee decides it really wants to put the ACA language into this bill, that we ought to talk and work with lawyers who are far smarter than I am to come up with the right language. I do want to address a couple of concerns that were brought up. We do have a full public comment period. The public comment period occurs before every decision is made. We do publish and notify the meetings at least 30 days in advance as required by law. We actually put working documents up 60 days in advance of the meeting so that the manufacturers and proponents who want to comment on the working documents can provide that before we put the final document up. I would be a little nervous about a schedule. I know that came up. As this committee and every other committee knows, that sometimes schedules aren't easy to follow. Sometimes schedules might cause you to short-circuit a discussion that maybe is an appropriate discussion in order to stay on schedule. And I am sympathetic to the concern with says if someone shows up at 1 o'clock and the discussion doesn't come until 4, but I don't know how to answer that, and I'm not sure how to address that. Translation. All documents, if we are contacted, will be translated. That's the policy of the health authority. And just like you say in your documents, we say that if you need special assistance, we will be happy to provide it. And so it's just a matter of contacting us for that. So in general, the bill doesn't really bother us. We think we do everything. We are very concerned about the so-called ACA language.
Great. Yes, Senator Cruz.
My sense of ACA being amended anytime soon is it ain't gonna happen. I think in any way, shape, or form, I would be interested, and from that perspective, by the way, we make changes in law based on federal changes in law all the time anyway. I will say I'm a little bit not quite sure why the notwithstanding language is there, and that may be something to be discussed. But just to state what is in ACA and will be probably, I'm guessing for at least the next 4 years, would probably be appropriate. So, but I can understand the concern with the notwithstanding. Maybe we can make a modification there.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. Proponents of the bill, I would be interested in removing that last part, but I think the bill should really, I think it's a good bill, and if you will work with Sandy on amendments, that would be great. All right, with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 777 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2131A, and I only want to take about 10 minutes on this bill, so please keep your remarks very, very brief. All right. Nellie DeVries, Deborah Cafori.
Kind of an itchy subject, you know.
Stop.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2131 comes to the Senate with the House floor vote of 55 ayes and 1 no, 4 excused. It requires that certain information pertaining to bed bug infestations to be held confidentially by public health authorities and exempts the information from disclosure under public records laws. This has an emergency clause as well. There's a minimal fiscal impact on the bill in its current form and no revenue impact.
Good afternoon. Chair Morales Anderson, members of the committee. I'm Deborah Cafori, Multnomah County Commissioner. And I appreciate the opportunity today to talk to you about House Bill 2131, which will help our county collect data to track the spread of bed bugs. 2 years ago, housing and social service advocates came to me to discuss an urgent and growing concern, bed bugs. At that time, most people, myself included, were unaware that bed bugs had arrived in our state. But the cost of bed bug treatments was already beginning to have a major financial impact on social service providers. And they knew that if they didn't act quickly, bed bugs could easily get out of control and could seriously disrupt their ability to fund basic services. Bed bugs are not picky. They will infest anyone's home, business, or organization. But unfortunately, those least able to afford the treatments are often those who are at most at risk of contracting bed bugs. As a first step, we at Multnomah County created a work group bringing together business leaders, nonprofits, schools, pest control companies, and government agencies to determine the extent of the problem and to develop a community-wide work plan. Through this collaboration, the work group has established and delivered protocols and information for prevention and treatment that are being used throughout the community. But what we don't have is the ability to track trends in infestations. This legislation, if passed, will allow pest control companies to voluntarily provide data to our public health department that can be aggregated to show infestation trends and allow us to put our scarce resources where they can be most effectively used. This legislation protects that information from public disclosure so we can ensure that these companies can maintain their client confidentiality. This legislation does not change any of the current reporting requirements of the pest control operators. Appreciate your time today, and I hope that you will support the bill.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Duncan. I'm the program manager for the Health Equity Initiative with Multnomah County Health Department and formerly worked in environmental health with Multnomah County Health Department as well. And I'll keep this really brief and reiterate just a couple points. One, that the first question we often receive in public health is how bad of a problem is this? And we really don't know the answer to that. So this bill really provides an opportunity for us to really collect that information so we can understand trends and allocate resources effectively and appropriately. And finally, just to reiterate what Commissioner Cafori said, this is voluntary information and that the inspection records that are public today will remain public after this bill is passed. No public record is impacted. It only affects the new and voluntary supplied reports by pest management professionals. So I'll just leave it there. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we're happy to answer questions if you have them.
Let's go ahead with the...
Okay. My name is Bruce Head. I'm president of Pioneer Pest Management and representing the Oregon Pest Control Association. I'd just like to echo their comments. Oregon Pest Control Association does support this bill. We like the fact that we can just feel confident that the information we're providing to the county will remain confidential. It is kind of a touchy subject with bed bugs, and folks that have those infestations are you know, going through quite a bit, and it's a great idea to be able to provide this information to the county and allow it to remain confidential. So we, as an organization, do support this House bill as well.
I don't care.
Evidently, Nellie isn't here.
Chair, could I just say, so I have a copy of their testimonies. They weren't able to be here. I have one copy, so we can make that available.
I think have it already. I think she emailed it to us this morning.
And she's from the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, and she is in support.
I'll just say really quickly that they do support the bill.
That's great.
Thanks.
All right. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I'd just say Commissioner Kefauri doesn't grace us with her presence very often, but it's always something very interesting when she shows up. So.
Very important.
Yes.
Well, it is a public health issue and extremely important. And so with that, Senator Cano.
Madam Chair, I know you only wanted to spend 10 minutes on this bill, but I have 2.5 hours of questions for Commissioner Kefauri. So I don't know if you just want to hold this over, have another hearing, have an evening hearing, whatever works for you, Madam Chair.
I might overrule all of your questions, but that's all right.
I don't know, free speech, Madam
Chair. All right, no, really? Seriously? Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2131A and open the first session on House Bill 2131A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2131A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2131A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Niche subject, I'll tell you that.
Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye, and motion passes. Who would like to carry this bill?
I think Senator Knope should carry it. He had all the questions.
Senator Knope will carry the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That seems like justice.
All right. With that, I will close the work session. And also, it would be nice on 20... House Bill 2131A, and President Courtney, I would like him to come down. I would like to wait a few minutes while he comes down. Could you call his office so we are in recess just for a couple of minutes? I'd like to reconvene the Senate Committee on Health Care and Human Services and would like to call Senator Peter Courtney and Senator Betsy Johnson was to come, but she's not quite here yet, and Dr. Drucker.
Right.
Why don't you sit in the middle? Sit in the middle. Because you're the guy. You're the guy. You're the rock star. They don't want to hear from me. They want to hear from you.
Okay. I'm waiting for you.
Thank you, Chairman Sanderson, and Vice Chair Cruz, Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward. And Senator Tim Knope, I'm beginning to see Senator Tim Knope in my dreams. Everywhere I go, he's in my life. And so here we go again. He was a no earlier, and so it's not going very good now. But so my name is Peter Courtney, and I live in Northeast Salem. I'm a state senator for District 11, which includes major portions of Salem and Jervis and Woodbury. In fact, I'm privileged to say this very building, state capitol, is in my district. I'm here today to support this measure regarding HB 2896. Now, I want to begin by saying it's clear to all of you I don't have a medical background. I'm a social scientist and a very poor one at that. By that I mean just, you know, history, English, and political science is what I majored in, including even when I went on law school and everything. So I have no medical background. But I really was not going to testify on the bill, but then here I'm testifying on it. And the reason is the word cancer. The word cancer is a horrible, horrible, horrible word to those individuals who get cancer. What it will do to you physically is well documented. Often what is not documented is what it does to you mentally. And also what it does to your family. That's another whole story which is hardly ever told. And while we're talking about melanoma, and I've never had melanoma, I do have skin cancer, the kind at which they have to come a dermatologist every so often and do things to me because it's that kind. I'm not going to brag much about myself, simply say I have had colon cancer. And all I want to say is that I will never recover from it. I will never, ever recover from it. Even though a certain doctor told me I was cured, I said, no, I'm not. Psychologically, I will never, ever, ever be cured from cancer. And so the only reason I'm here today is when I hear the word cancer and I have any opportunity to stop somebody, maybe from getting it, then I'm going to try to do it in my own little feeble way. So that's why I'm here. That's as simple as that. And if we're going to make a mistake in over-regulation, let's do it in the area of stopping children from maybe getting cancer. That's all I'm going to say. And that's why I'm here. We're talking about a bill that talks about young people, the loved ones, and the only thing wrong with children or adults. And so I'm going to quote a few things given to me by the experts, but I never did this research. The great one is sitting next to me. The great one is sitting next to me, one of the greatest cancer doctors in the entire country. And one of my caucus members once said, one day they think he'll receive the Nobel Peace Prize. We'll see. Medicine. But he has done that well. Medicine. So we have the Mayo Clinic proceedings in 2012, the risk of developing melanoma, the deadliest type of skin cancer, it will kill you. It will kill you. Is now more than 6 times higher among young adults than it was 40 years ago. Another reason I'm here is, and I'm really messed up over this, I learned 2 years ago that my godchild, who is my nephew, adopted by my younger brother's wife, has melanoma. He's completely messed up in the hills in Rhode Island. He was in the Navy as a nuclear subs for 5 years. I would give anything if he would answer the phone and come out here, because I would send him to Oregon Health Science University. He's given up. And so I am experiencing some of this. And I'm not saying it's tanning booths that gave him melanoma. I'm just saying I have a personal connection now to the most dreaded form of skin cancer. Melanoma is the second most common cancer in women between the ages of 20 and 35, and the leading cause of cancer death in women ages 25 to 30. Now, I don't know if these are true or not, because I'm not a doctor. But I'm not just flim-flamming here. We have the certified smart people here to talk about these. Mayo Clinic researchers say the dynamic rise in melanoma rates among the young is the most likely due to increased use of tanning beds since 1970, as well as, I want to be honest about this, as other is other unsafe exposure to ultraviolet rays, such as severe sunburns in childhood. So I want to make it clear here that while I am talking about the tanning bed, the fact is other suns can get you too. The best way to reduce the risk of melanoma and other types of skin cancer is to limit exposure to ultraviolet radiation from tanning beds in the sun. Okay? Mayo Clinic researcher and dermatologist Jerry Brewer said, a recent study reported that people who use indoor tanning beds frequently are 75% more likely to develop melanoma. 74%. All of the adults in this room know one thing. When you're young, at least when I was young, you think you're invincible. You think you're invincible. It's interesting. While we think we're invincible, we limit children from using tobacco and alcohol. Well, it seems to me we should do something also about this, the possibility, even the smallest possibility, they might get skin cancer. I support this bill because of the kids. It's first and foremost because of the kids and because of that dreaded word, cancer. And so I know that probably my words will not persuade any of you, and you can attack me for a lot of things, but I can just tell you, I hope you never have a child or you never have someone that you dearly love say, I've got cancer. More importantly, I hope you never get that call from a doctor's office. I really do. Because I will tell you, you will never, ever recover, regardless of your treatment. And I know about treatments. I know about 5 years. The word terror, I have never fought in combat. I don't know what it's like to fight in terror combat. All I know is the only time I truly experienced terror in my life is when I had cancer. I was terrified. To this day, when I go to see a doctor, if something's not right with me, I start to shake. The terror all comes back. And so I will do whatever I can to stop at least young people from possibly ever knowing that terror. And that's why I support this bill. It's as simple as that. It begins there and it ends there. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of serving Senate District 16. Colleagues, ordinarily this isn't the kind of bill that I would sign on to, but I signed on as a co-chief sponsor because of my personal relationship with Dr. Drucker, the director of the OHSU Knight Cancer Institute. I have enormous respect for Dr. Drucker. His work has changed the landscape of cancer treatment worldwide and has touched millions of lives. His breakthrough research has led to the development of the drug Gleevec, which still holds the record for the fastest drug ever approved by the FDA. He's the recipient of the Lasker Award, frequently referred to as the U.S. equivalent of the Nobel Prize in Medicine. Patients who were literally in hospice when Gleevec was first tested in clinical trials in the late 1990s have been able to resume their normal lives and are now expected to live a normal lifespan. Before Gleevec, these cancer patients would have had a 3 to 5 year life expectancy after diagnosis. The research behind Gleevec proved that it was possible for a drug to zero in on only the molecules that were malfunctioning inside a patient's cells without harming the healthy cells. The discovery ushered in a new era of truly personalized cancer care in medicine, an era in which treatments are designed to target the specific biology of a patient's disease. Now as many as 40 targeted cancer drugs are available to patients and hundreds more in clinical trials. This groundbreaking work in targeted cancer cells started here in Oregon. And I think that there's a high probability that Dr. Drucker will ultimately become a Nobel Prize recipient in medicine because of this work. His work inspired a $100 million transformational gift from Nike chairman Phil Knight and his wife Penny. With that gift and other substantial donations, Dr. Drucker is assembling a team of top scientists and clinicians at the Knight Cancer Institute to treat Oregonians with the latest and best cancer therapies close to home. I give you all of this background by way of saying this is a guy that I trust on this issue. I trust him implicitly, and so do people worldwide. You will hear from Dr. Drucker the science behind the link of UV tanning beds and cancer. That link is incontrovertible. What I did not know before he brought this issue to my attention was how UV tanning beds pose an even greater risk for minors. If you use UV tanning beds before the age of 35, you are 75% more likely to get a melanoma in your lifetime. That's why I strongly believe in this bill and the need to regulate UV tanning. excuse me. As the House Health Care Committee learned directly from the suntanning advocates, the Food and Drug Administration and the Federal Trade Commission forbid the indoor tanning industry from using the word safe or safer than regarding indoor tanning, despite the fact that the indoor tanning industry has been forbidden by the FTC from promoting any health benefits of tanning in its marketing due to the lack of scientific evidence. They still claim that indoor tanning offers a controlled environment to obtain a tan. As you will hear today from Dr. Drucker, there are a number of studies that demonstrate that indoor tanners are quite likely to get burned and suffer other skin damage during their indoor tanning sessions. I have seen the Dash 3, the Dash 4 amendments, the Dash 5 amendments, and I don't support any of them because they severely weaken the bill. I understand the opponents want to lower the age to 16. This completely undermines the bill since we know teens usually start tanning at around age 16. We know that 40% of teens between 16 and 18 are using indoor tanning. Lowering the age would undermine the whole point of the bill. A task force is the legislative equivalent of killing the bill. I oppose that. I have also heard that the industry is concerned that this prohibition will drive more teens to tan at home. First, I would submit to you that the average home system costs between $2,000 and $3,000, which seems pretty expensive for teens to purchase, and probably they're not their highest priority. And since this is a different activity, trying to regulate a behavior that may occur at home, we have indicated our willingness to study the issue and come back with a thoughtful approach. I also want to say a little bit about the process so far because the opponents of the bill will probably express concerns. The bill has been public for a full 2 weeks before its first hearing. During this time, the bill was extensively reported on in the media. There were at least 48 articles in different news outlets before the hearing. The opponents of the bill were effective enough during that same period to kill the bill or a similar bill in Washington. A public hearing was posted 5 days in advance, which was enough time for the American Suntanning Association to fly someone here from Colorado to testify during the public hearing. There was also testimony from the local tanning owners during the hearing. And public hearings are just that. They're open to the public. And for the notion that the supporters of this bill did not try to reach out to the industry before introducing it, this is the public process. There shouldn't be any surprise to the industry. 28 other states have introduced legislation since the beginning of 2013 to try to protect minors from indoor tanning. And finally, as you will see from the written testimony submitted today from Blair Oman, indoor tanning causes a real human toll. This 30-year-old woman tanned for years. She's my constituent, lives in Astoria, and has developed stage 3 melanoma. She is 31 weeks pregnant right now, so she can't travel to Salem to tell her story in person. But I'm here supporting this bill for patients like her. Minors should be protected from cancer. This bill will do exactly that, and I thank Dr. Drucker for his courageous advocacy on this important subject.
Thank you. Dr. Drucker.
Thank you, Chair Monis-Anderson, member of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Drucker. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm the director of the OHS Unite Cancer Institute and devoted my career to improving cancer treatment. I'm here to speak, share my professional opinion, also to speak on behalf of Oregon Health and Sciences University. As you heard from Senator Johnson, there's testimony from several patients. I'm also here to speak on behalf of one of my patients, Ashley Trenner. Ashley was 15 when she started using indoor tanning booths. At age 33, she developed stage 4 melanoma. We treated her over 7 years and significantly prolonged her life. Ashley died on Friday in her parents' arms at home with hospice. Ashley hoped and wished that others would learn the dangers of indoor tanning, and I'm here speaking on her behalf and her family's behalf, who are eager to hear how this the outcome of this legislation. We made so much progress in fighting cancer, but there's still much more work to be done. When I became the director of the Knight Cancer Institute, one of my goals was to make the cancer death rate in Oregon one of the lowest in the nation. Even though some cancers are highly treatable, prevention still is a top priority. House Bill 2896, as you know, restricts children younger than 18 from using indoor tanning devices unless documentation physician recommendation is provided. Evidence continues to mount that we're not doing enough to protect young people from skin cancer. In the past 3 decades, more people have had skin cancer than all other cancers combined.
Further, the disease impacts Oregonians disproportionately. The melanoma death rate for women in Oregon is the highest in the country, and the state has the nation's fourth highest overall death rate for melanoma. The human toll of these statistics represent is deeply disturbing to me because skin cancer is highly preventable. We know that limiting exposure to UV light, especially in young people, is one of the best ways to prevent this disease. The evidence is clear. UV tanning booths, like cigarettes, cause cancer, and they should be off limits to minor in that same fashion. The scientific evidence that UV tanning booths cause cancer is so strong and so indisputable that the Food and Drug Administration categorizes tanning beds as a level one carcinogen, the same designation it gives to tobacco. We know that UV tanning beds cause cancer because radiation directly or indirectly leads to breaks in your DNA. This leads to mutations in the DNA, which ultimately leads to cancer. Please don't be misled by claims that there are safe UV types. Scientists agree that all types of UV are linked to cancer. What many children and parents may not know is the risk associated with UV exposure even higher for minors than adults. You heard from Senator Johnson the study that said that tanning before 35 has a 75% higher risk of developing melanoma. The younger the exposure, the higher the risk. Limiting minors' access to indoor UV tanning beds is a significant way we can help limit UV exposure. We understand or recognize there are other factors that increase one's risk of skin cancer, like ethnicity or outdoor sun exposure, but we can't do anything to legislate those risks. But this bill targets a risk-taking behavior in children that we do have the ability to prevent, and I'm hoping we can take that opportunity to prevent this. As an oncologist who's made a commitment to do everything in my power to decrease Oregon's cancer rates, I have two options before me. One is I could ask you to fund massive education campaigns that would cost us millions of dollars per year, and we'd have to invest in that every year to have an impact. The other option is this bill to ensure that this cancer-causing activity is off limits for children unless discussed and approved by a physician. This bill is necessary because discouraging sunbed use or requiring parental authorization has not been effective. As you've heard, studies indicate that between 40% of teens aged 16 to 18 are using tanning beds, and this coincides with a recent increase in melanoma incidence among young U.S. women. As part of today's testimony, you'll hear from a young woman who shared how she begged her parents to be able to visit a tanning salon because that's what her friends were doing. She never dreamed she'd end up with melanoma at age 23. You may hear today that low doses of UV can be administered in a safe and controlled setting that is less damaging than sun exposure. This idea is that there's a safe way to tan is a myth. The argument is essentially the same as saying that smoking a few cigarettes a day is okay, or that using low-tar nicotine cigarettes will be less harmful and then protect your lungs from regular cigarette exposure. There's no evidence that indoor tanning before sun exposure provides protection against sunburn, and unfortunately, any change in skin color is evidence of skin damage from UV radiation. The simple fact is that UV exposure causes cancer, and as much as we do to ban sales of tobacco products to anyone under 18, we should do the same for UV tanning devices and protect our most vulnerable individuals. Tanning advocates will say there are health benefits from tanning. These include increasing vitamin D levels and treatment for medical conditions such as psoriasis or eczema. We agree there are potential health benefits, but in the case of vitamin D, there are easily accessible, safe alternatives that do not cause cancer, including food and nutritional supplements, and that provide nutritional supplements that provide a good source of vitamin D without exposure to UV. For diseases like psoriasis and eczema or other medical conditions, the legislation does allow access to tanning booths, but only after the benefits have been discussed with a physician. Some may be concerned about the business aspects. Again, there are safe alternatives to the use of tanning booths. Most tanning booths offer spray tanning that uses a chemical that's been on the market since 1976 and the FDA deems as safe. In fact, there are already several tanning salons in Oregon, including one in Beaverton, Hood River, and the Dalles, which exclusively use the spray tanning method. They've deliberately eliminated UV tanning booths to their concerns about the risk of causing cancer. So even within the industry, there's a business model that can be successfully used. In closing, I've had a chance to review some of the tanning industry's proposed amendments. As you heard from Senator Johnson, all three would severely undermine the bill's intent. Amendment 3 creates a task force to study the issue. As I mentioned, we already know that UV tanning causes cancer. A task force is going to make that same conclusion and doesn't protect our children now. Amendment 4 lowers the age at which children can use a tanning to 16. Again, this would weaken the bill tremendously. You've heard that 40% of teenagers are using indoor tanning between the ages of 16 to 18. Lastly, Amendment 5 codifies what's in current Oregon regulations into law, which allows parental consent. Again, we know that this is not working. We're asking that the same consideration for a known level 1 carcinogen, regulation of tobacco, lack of access under 18, we do the same thing for UV tanning, the same act, same level of control for a known carcinogen. I welcome your questions and ask for your support of this important legislation. It's my hope that our state will protect our children, we will save lives, and we'll lower the death rate from cancer in Oregon. Thank you very much for your time today.
Questions for the panel?
The statistic that really hit me was 40%. Now, is that both boys and girls?
Thank you, Senator Cruz. That is Caucasian girls between 16 to 18.
Okay. That is a striking number. I would have never had guessed it was that high.
Just
a quick comment. I as a family physician, I like you, and you and I have had many conversations about this. I'm so focused on prevention because it's much easier and better to prevent a disease than to try to cure it, especially with one as difficult to cure as melanoma. So I'm very, very glad that this legislation is here, and I strongly support, and I thank Senator Courtney and Senator Johnson for advocating for it.
There's one question that I do have. When I read the bill, it says that a tanning facility may not allow a person who is under 18 years of age to use a tanning device. And so I would assume that would include UV free spray tanning. And I would like to make sure that the bill is explicit saying that that someone under the age of 18 could go in for the UV-free spray tanning.
Yes, thank you, Chair. That should be clear. That was certainly the intent, that it was the UV tanning devices, not the spray tanning.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Is that not clear? I'm just going to look at
it. If you could stay for the remaining of the testimony, we may have questions after we hear the rest testify.
Yes.
But thank you, Senator Courtney and Senator Johnson. With that, I would like to call up Dr. Bud Pierce, Katie Wilkes, and Bridget Thomas.
Hello, Chair, Senator Montes-Anderson, committee members. I'm Dr. Bud Pierce. I'm president of the Oregon Medical Association, 8,100 members in strong support of House Bill 2896. I have submitted written testimony, but in deliberating this, I'd like you to think about three numbers, 95, 75, and 20. So 95% of cancers are environmental. Only 5% are genetic. We hear all about the genetic risk, but 95% are environmental. So in order to decrease the incidence of cancer, we have to improve the environment. The World Health Organization's International Agency for Cancer Research publishes a list of cancer-causing agents. There are 75 agents on that list, not a million, 75. Number 74 is UV irradiation, types A and B. So UV irradiation is number 74 out of 75. Third number was 20. 20 is a number of types of exposures listed by the World Health Organization associated with the development of cancer. Number 19 on that list is tanning beds. Number 20 is smoking cigarettes. So we got 95% of cancers preventable. We have the agent discussed today on the list of agents that causes cancer. It's a category one, as was mentioned. And the behavior, i.e. tanning, is one of the 20 behaviors that lead to an increased risk of cancer, i.e. melanoma and other skin cancers. So that's, I think, the key points today that we're talking about. Our obligation as adults are to protect the children of our society. We protect our own children. We need to protect society's children. We need to prevent child abuse, tobacco smoking, and children getting cancer from tanning. So that's our obligation today. And my obligation as a medical oncologist, I've been doing this for 35, 36 years. I have a PhD in experimental pathology. It doesn't matter to me what people do as long as it's safe. I'm not pro or against tanning other than the fact that it can cause cancer. So therefore, I'm against tanning on that basis. And I'd ask you to, as our leaders, to ban tanning for minors and do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Katie Wilkes and I live in Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. The first time I used a tanning bed, I was 16 years old. Like most teenagers, I was very self-conscious about my appearance, especially after being teased for having ghostly white skin as a kid. At first, my mom refused to let me tan. She would say things like, "You're beautiful the way you are," and tell me about how tanning would make my skin look like leather by the time I turned 30. But no matter what she said, I hated the way I felt when I looked in the mirror. So many other girls were tanning and then comparing their tan lines during lunch break, so why shouldn't I be able to do it too? After months and months of begging, my mom finally caved and I started visiting tanning salons with my friends. Many salons in Portland never even bothered to check my ID to see if I was underage, let alone keep track of how many minutes I spent in the beds. If you've never used a tanning bed before, the bulbs can be pretty intense. I always preferred tanning indoors because I could develop color in as little as 5 minutes. I didn't need to lay outside in the sun for 3 or 4 hours. Tanning salons often promoted unlimited packages, which allowed me to tan as many times as I wanted for a set monthly fee. I frequently purchased the unlimited packages because it was cheaper than buying individual tanning sessions. One summer in particular, determined to get my money's worth, I tanned every single day for 30 days. When I was 16, I was an honor roll student at St. Mary's Academy in downtown Portland. Oddly enough, that's part of what made tanning okay. It wasn't as bad as smoking or drinking, and even the good girls wanted to be tanned for prom and senior portraits. By the time I turned 18, I was tanning at least once a week, sometimes more. I never in a million years imagined I would be diagnosed with malignant melanoma, the most deadly type of skin cancer, at age 23. I found out on the third day of work at my first full-time job. Within days, I was referred to a surgical oncologist who made a 3-inch incision on the side of my right breast. I was lucky enough to catch my melanoma before it spread, but that's what's so scary about melanoma. It's not just skin cancer. It's unpredictable, and it can grow from stage 1 to stage 4 in a heartbeat. I continue to be haunted by anxieties that I'll develop a second melanoma. Many survivors do, including one of my friends, and maybe I won't be so lucky next time. At age 16, I thought I understood the risks of tanning, but who really thinks they're going to get cancer before starting their first full-time job? In reality, melanoma has become the most frequently diagnosed cancer for women my age, and it's not going to stop unless we do what we can to protect children from the dangers of indoor UV tanning. I know that my mom regrets letting me tan, but how could she have known that tanning beds were so dangerous? Many of my friends' parents still think it's smart to get a base tan before going on vacation, or that you need to tan to get enough vitamin D. So who can we trust to find reliable information about this? A couple of years ago, I went to a tanning salon to get a UV-free spray tan, and a salon employee tried to sell me a UV tanning package, even though I told them I had a history of melanoma. A tanning salon employee has also told me that tanning beds are so high-tech these days that we don't have to worry about what he called the C-word anymore. Well, if that were true, how do you explain the cancer that I developed on my chest, skin that has never been exposed to sunlight, but that received hours and hours of UV exposure in tanning beds? I think the worst part of all this is, if I had to do it all over again, I don't know if I could have done anything differently. Until our society starts to embrace pale skin as beautiful, there's nothing that will keep a 16-year-old out of a tanning bed short of a ban. By passing this bill, we have the power to make a statement that tanning beds are dangerous and to curb the escalating rate of melanoma diagnosis in Oregon. I ask your support of this bill, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for coming and sharing your story.
Actually, Madam Chair, she is beautiful.
I know.
I would just say that as a parent, the best letter I got from my daughter at camp this summer was one where she said, I ran out of sunscreen. Mom, will you ship me some more really quickly, please?
Hello, I'm Bridget Thomas. Thank you for having me here. At age 15, a friend and I went into a stand-up tanning booth at her parents' private spa. Not being told to wear goggles or to shut my eyes, I had second-degree burns on my eyes, along with a painful burn to my body that resulted at midnight. At age 16, I started working at a tanning salon that allowed us to tan for free. At age 20, I was managing that salon. At age 25, I purchased that salon with 16 tanning beds and 3 levels of tanning. Majority of my customers progressed to the 3rd level of tanning in a short amount of time, if not for their first time, and requested the high-performance tanning bed versus the level 1 tanning one. I was involved with Miss Hawaiian Tropics, Miss Budweiser, Miss Miller, several liquor promotion companies. Being tan and looking good was important to me. This has resulted in 11 surgeries. Three surgeries were last month, one more next week. I have had acid pills on my face trying to stop and kill the cancer from growing. Between topical creams, freezing, acid pills, biopsy here, biopsy there, I came to the decision to just please do the surgery and cut it out of me and pray it does not come back. Majority of my surgeries are on the pressure points from laying on the tanning beds. Most tanning beds have a minimum of 24 tanning bulbs with a maximum of 64, or it could be more now, along with 3 intense facial tanning windows. Regardless of 24 or 64 tanning bulbs, it is extremely dangerous. The American Academy of Dermatology notes that the use of tanning bed increases the risk of melanoma in the most deadly form of skin cancer. Statistics prove that people who use any type of tanning bed for any length of time are 74% more likely to develop melanoma, and frequent users of indoor tanning beds are 2 to 3 times more likely to develop melanoma. As most teens and young adults, I thought, pish-posh, that will never happen to me. Exactly what I thought, and thought this for years. It did not stop there. I opened another salon. I have been in a lot of different tanning salons. The main salon that will never get out of my mind is the one with the high-pressure tanning and brand-new bulbs, which I was not informed of, nor given the reduced tanning time. Approximately 1.5 hours later, my body was tingling and itching, turning redder and redder by the hour. This resulted with second and third degree burns to my entire body. This salon had no remorse, no sympathy, no suggestions for a remedy, which I knew there was none. The salon had no certified tanning instructor, and even if it would have, I honestly do not think it would have prevented this. Not owners, employees, or customers go by the rules and regulations. Banning tanning for those 18 and under will hopefully reduce the statistics of skin cancer. I definitely would not want anyone to go through what I am going through, although I am one of the luckier ones. I am not having to go through chemo. I do not have a date labeled on me. I can still do everything I used to do except for tan, and that is okay with me. Thank you.
It took a lot to come and share your story, and my heart does go out to both of you, and thank you so much. All right.
Thank you.
With that, I would like to call Peter Lampkett. And
good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee. We're going to get the AV started here. My name is Peter Lampka. I'm from Portland, Oregon. And after listening to that testimony, a part of me says, oh my goodness, there are some brilliant men that are obviously there. There's a lot of passion. There's a lot of emotion here. Fortunately, there are two sides of this story. And so it's my obligation to bring the other side.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Peter, before you continue, you said you're from Portland, Oregon. Are you representing somebody or are you just representing yourself?
Represents, we own Tan Republic. We've got 20 stores in Portland.
Okay. So you're a small business owner?
Indeed.
Okay, thank you.
My maternal grandfather died of leukemia when I was 12 years old. My paternal grandfather got skin cancer when I was a freshman at Wentworth University, and I watched this giant of a man who'd been the dean of the University of Puget Sound cut down, literally, had his leg amputated and finally succumbed to the disease. Cancer has been a part of my family, and I've watched it closely. I'm a huge advocate of health and fitness, and in fact, after playing football in undergrad, after working for a state senator in Washington for a year, I went to law school, and I coached the undergrad football team there. So I've been very passionate about health and fitness my entire life. And with that said, my wife and I control 20 stores, Tan Republic stores, in the Portland metropolitan area. Tan Republic's the largest chain of tanning salons between Seattle and San Diego. So while we are small business owners, we're health advocates. You've heard that tanning beds generate UV, and UV causes cancer. And I submit to you, the new science shows the correlation is not causation. And it's not going to be me that's going to say that. It's going to be a bunch of very intelligent doctors. And I'm so glad that the WHO has been cited, not the Rock Group, but the World Health Organization has been cited, these statistics, because I'm going to look at them carefully with you. OHSU recently tweeted to their employees the day Dr. Druker was speaking before the House Committee on this bill. Get enough vitamin D? This infograph may surprise you. Kind of surprised me. The infograph points out that UVB may burn your skin, but it also creates vitamin D, which is essential for bone health. Can we get the next slide? Essential for bone health and positively impacts cardiovascular disease and some cancers. Let me read that again. This is from OHSU. It's essential for bone health, positively impacts cardiovascular disease and some cancers. It also improves mood, arthritis, and helps with teenage diabetes. That's not my words, that's OHSU's. Clearly there's a bit of disagreement in the medical community over the positive effects of UV exposure in moderation. Dr. Edward Giovannucci, a Harvard University professor of medicine and nutrition, I believe one of Dr. Druker's associates during his time at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute at Harvard Med, he's one of the world's leading specialists on the effects of vitamin D in the body. He's a keynote speaker recently at the American Association for Cancer Research. He stated during this talk that his research suggests vitamin D might help prevent 30 deaths for each one caused by skin cancer. Afterwards, the American Cancer Association's chief epidemiologist, Dr. Michael Thune, said he was so impressed that the ACA is going to review its sun protection guidelines. Another luminary in the medical field, Dr. Peter Greenwald, chief of cancer prevention for the National Cancer Institute, says, a dozen major studies are underway to test vitamin D's ability to ward off cancer, while two other recent studies report encouraging signs in treating prostate and lung cancer. In fact, vitamin D3 has been shown in multiple recent studies to protect against lymphoma and cancers of the prostate, lung, and ironically, the skin. So the new thinking is this. Even if too much sun leads to skin cancer, which is rarely deadly, though it can be, too little sun may be worse. Many scientists now believe that 15 minutes of UV a couple of times a week without sunscreen is actually helpful to health. And based off the infograph, that clearly includes some of the medical professionals at OHSU. You've heard some of the statements related to UV, vitamin D, and health. Now let's address some of those stats that have been bandied about in this hearing. You've been told the World Health Organization declares UV light a class 1 carcinogen. Yeah, it did. Absolutely. Let's look at some of the other things. It also lists wine, so Pinot Noir here, microbrews, even smoked salmon are on that list. The fact is when indoor tanning or Pinot or salted fish are experienced in their intended dosages, there's no elevated risk. So we're seeing a little bit of inflammatory rhetoric here. Let's look at the facts. You've been told that those tanning when they're young have a 75% greater chance of contracting cancer later in their life. It reminds me of a story that I was told once. Some balloonist is in London, and he decides it's a nice day and he's going to go check out the channel. Goes up a little bit too high, forgets that he's got, an oxygen problem, and as a result, passes out, ends up in a field somewhere. When he comes to, wakes up, and he sees a gentleman in the field. He says, "Excuse me, but can you tell me, where am I?" And the gentleman says, "Why, of course, you're in a large basket in a very big field." And that 75% statistic, I would hold, is much like the gentleman's answer. It's accurate, but it's absolutely useless in current form without some perspective. Now, let's look at that fact, and let's actually look at the number that comes from that World Health Organization paper. The study, the most comprehensive one ever done on the potential causal connection between UV exposure and melanoma, it followed 100,000 women for 8 years. Studied their behaviors, see what they did, and then see what happens later in life. At the end of the study, they found that less than 0.02% of women who did not tan developed melanoma, versus 0.03% of those that tan frequently. Thus, this off-stated, sometimes you hear 70%, 74, 75, but the statistic that WHO quoted in this study is actually talking about absolute versus relative risk. Now, for some perspective, smoking is related to 1 in 3 cancer deaths, with a relative risk of 2,000% more than for non-smokers. And yet we're hearing this bandied about tanning beds, smoking, as if they're somehow synonymous, when in reality, it might be easier and more accurate to say UV tanning in moderation, drinking some red wine, drinking Hefeweizen. The 2009 WHO study, this same study, it concludes, and I quote, Epidemiology studies to date give no consistent evidence that the use of indoor tanning facilities in general are associated with the development of melanoma or skin cancer. I know Dr. Drucker, he says otherwise, but we're citing the WHO when we're using the statistics, so let me read this again. The studies to date give no consistent evidence that the use of indoor tanning facilities in general are associated with the development of melanoma or skin cancer. Some more brief facts. You've been told that melanoma rates are continuing to rise among U.S. women. But in reality, the CDC, which tracks every death in the U.S., shows that deaths among women have been flat. Sorry, I'm not paying attention to my EV. Have been flat. No, keep going. There we go. Nope, back. Well, there we go. That's fine. Can we see the stat, please? All right, trust me. You can look to the right there, and you see that rates since 2005 have been pretty flat, right under 2%. Next slide. You've been told that melanoma is increasing faster and is more prevalent among women than men over the past 30 years. Again, CDC statistics show this is simply not the case. And in fact, the occurrence rates are more than double among men. Moreover, the growth of cancer is not limited to skin cancer, next slide, but includes many types of cancer, and we begin to witness this phenomena nearly 80, no, I'm winning the next one, I'm so sorry, there we go, this is CMM since 1940-ish, there were no tanning beds back then. I'm afraid indoor UV facilities weren't around to blame. You've been told that any exposure to UV increases the rate of getting melanoma. But the map, if we can get that, please. Oh, there's some more. Hold on just a second. This is looking at all forms of CMM at different parallels across the globe since 1940. And you see the same rather linear statistics for the last, 75 years? No tanning beds for a great part of that. And also, there are no tanning beds in many of, not all, but there are no tanning beds in parts of the world here where CMM continues to grow. We can get that map now. Here we go. something that Dr. Drucker said. I'm so glad he said that because I happen to have this map. It says that, Oregon is one of the four most prevalent states in the nation for getting CMM or melanoma. And he's absolutely right. We've got the Northwest, and I believe his home state of Minnesota is also right up there. What's interesting is we've heard testimony that the exposure to UV is supposed to lead to melanoma. But interestingly enough, the states that see the most UV year-round have the lowest rates. Again, correlation is not causation. Moreover, melanoma, which commonly appears in parts of the body that do not receive regular exposure to sunlight, which is counterintuitive if the UV exposure is the cause. That is, we're not getting melanoma so much on our arms and our faces. Dr. Drucker says he agrees that there are potential benefits to health benefits to vitamin D, but they can be found in, I believe he said, food products such as dairy and fish. We don't really have time today, but another well-known doctor disagrees, and I've got a great clip of Dr. Oz this year, advocating sunlight in the same vein as that OHSU tweet. That is, moderately, and with regular practice, but not banning it altogether, and not being no UV exposure whatsoever. You can watch the video later. We're going to obviously leave this here if you'd like. I do have a short...
How much longer
is it? 90 seconds.
Okay.
I do have a short clip of Dr. Michael Hollick, if you'd indulge, and just here for a second, discussing vitamin D and UV. He helped make the landmark discovery in how vitamin D affects the body nearly 30 years ago, and he's been the chief of endocrinology, nutrition, diabetes, and a professor of dermatology at Boston University. So if you'll indulge me, I'd like to him to speak for 2 or 3 minutes, and then I've got 20 seconds in closing. Okay, well, I guess Dr. Hollick doesn't want to talk. But what he says in this presentation here that maybe you guys can watch later in
the
chambers.
You can send it to the
absolutely.
Staff.
What he says is he kind of reiterates, obviously he's one of the world's foremost researchers on vitamin D. And he says, you need UV. And he studied for years people at Boston University. So the gist is, he calls them solariums, but that going regularly but moderately to a solarium for young people, college-age kids is what he's referring to them as. He says that that's positive, and he actually is an advocate. Now, he's not paid by a tanning bed association. He's speaking. This speech he gives is actually in front of 500 peers in Sweden, I believe. It has nothing to do with tanning, other than we found it and said, wow, this kind of makes our point. So in closing, this bill is bad legislation as it stands right now for 3 reasons. First off, in current form, it bans all indoor tanning for those under 18. We spoke about this yesterday. And reading that through my attorney's eyes, I believe this also covers the UV spray devices that even Dr. Drucker is advocating. Secondly, at banning all UV, it appears to ban red light therapy beds, which are frankly collateral damage in this firefight. Red light beds are collagen building, don't tan, and they do emit some UV, but it's at a much higher frequency. We're talking around 600 nanometers versus the, if we're talking A, B, or C, 100 to 420 nanometers. So we need to really focus about what we're talking, what we're discussing here to start with.
And what did you call it? Red light?
Red light therapy.
Red light therapy.
This bill also allows for any doctor to give consent, and I suppose that goes back to the days when general practitioners handled all forms of medicine. As doctors and lawyers, we're very specialized today. If you need a trust set up in the Cook Islands, I'm somebody to talk to, but if you're getting a divorce, I wouldn't even barely know where to start. By the same token, I wouldn't trust my orthopedic surgeon if I had a neonatal problem. Yet we're going to trust any doctor to prescribe UV for our kids. As you've heard, there's a lot of conflicting science out there. And many of the world's leading UV researchers, doctors, advocate for moderate, regular doses of UV for vitamin D3, just like that infograph at OHSU. We need more dialogue so that together we can get this right. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And I do want to get the rest of the people who have come to testify And so if you want, can we get everyone on the record first and then ask questions?
Sure.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure we get some medical input to make sure that we clarify some of those issues at some point.
Thank you very much. Mitch Teal, Todd Evans, and Brittany Evans.
And Julie Evans.
And I don't know if we need all of them.
And Julie. They're hooked, so I think that Ashley can help. Please proceed.
Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Mitch Teal. I'm the owner of Bronze Planet Tanning Studios here in town. I have three different locations. What I wanted to talk about today was the unintended consequences of House Bill 2896. As a father who has two teenage daughters and an older son, I know how the teenage mind works, and I know that bans typically do not work on children. The unintended consequences, teens will burn in unregulated environments as they will tan outside, tanning in home tanning equipment and unscrupulous indoor tanning facilities. People who would, the professionals that are here in town, I don't feel would tan underage people, but there are a few places that might tan underage people. I believe that a lot of the people who could not get a doctor's note would certainly go find those facilities. Just like when I was a teenager, you could find the store that would sell the underage child beer or cigarettes. Many of the under 18 clients mentioned these options repeatedly when I asked how an under 18 ban would affect them in my stores personally. Typical comment would be, well, that's not going to stop me. I have a friend who has a tanning bed, or I can just go in and give him a fake ID, or I can go in and get my doctor to write me a prescription. Currently, Craigslist has over 29 beds. That's today. 29 tanning beds in the Salem area alone, not in Oregon, but in the Salem area alone, used tanning beds, most of them under $500, and a lot of them $200 to $300. And they plug right into the wall. You don't have a special electrician or any special permits or any process to go through. It's an easy and affordable alternative. You can purchase much more expensive tanning beds, but the used market is flooded. And this House bill would not stop teens from finding those areas to tan in. The at-home tanning manufacturers will certainly increase marketing and see substantial growth in sales in Oregon. In fact, if you Google this House bill, some of the banners on top of that Google will be indoor or in-home tanning manufacturers that are out there ready to sell indoor tanning units. And even a relatively nice unit that plugs right in, $1,200 to $1,800 for a brand new one, $200 to $300 for a used one. On top of that, I'm certain that one unregulated home unit purchased by Sally 17 will be utilized by exponentially more minors in a free-for-all fashion with no eyewear, no sanitation standards, no skin typing, no exposure schedule, or even correct lamp configuration. All of those things are regulated in a professional tanning facility. In that scenario, the probability for creating even more than the current number of minors turning to unregulated home tanning exposure seems highly probable. Myself and many other professional tanning salon operators are committed to provide regulated, sanitized, and supervised facilities in which to tan. We are passionate about our clients' well-being and applaud the existing regulations for indoor tanning already in place in Oregon. But the unintended consequences of this proposed regulation has the potential to create frightening in-home use consequences. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chairs. Committee members. My name's Todd Evans, and I'm here with my family, my wife and daughter, and we're not here on behalf of any tanning industry. We're strictly a customer, and we have no affiliations with them at all. We're here just as parents, basically, because my daughter's prepared a statement that what tanning has helped her through her, she's had about 10 years worth of cancer over the years, and she'll tell her story of how it's helped her.
Thank you.
Hi.
When I was a junior in high school.
Say your name for the record.
Sorry. Brittany Evans. When I was 17, I was a junior in high school. I developed a secondary skin cancer called lymphomatoid papulosis CD30 positive, or the easy name is LYP. I went into a specialty dermatologist up at OHSU, and I was also being followed by an oncologist at the same time. The condition itself presented on my face, and it looked like I had open wounds all over my face, and it was very itchy and just very uncomfortable and not fun to deal with. All the treatments that the doctors have prescribed me, like pills, creams, oral chemotherapy, and even like a photo light therapy, which sort of reminded me of a tanning bed, but you stand up and it's way more stronger, they did not work. The photo light therapy actually made me extremely sick, and so I went to my doctor and I asked, well, what about a tanning bed? Would that work, since that kind of reminded me of the same thing? And he said, absolutely not. I will not ever recommend that. And so, being 17, I just kind of didn't want to listen. And my mom, you know, we were desperate, so we would have tried anything. So she took me to the tanning salon, and after about, 2 weeks of going three times a week for 15 minutes, my face was cleared. I didn't have any open wounds on my face or anything. I was completely fine. And I went back to my doctor, and I walked in, and he said, oh, my gosh, you look great. What did you do? And I said, well, I went tanning. And he goes, oh, okay. And he had a look of shock on his face, but he told me that I should then start tanning only when I was having outbreaks on my face, because clearly it helped, and that I should go for three times a week for 15 minutes each. It's been 6 years since I have done that, and I've only had minimal reoccurrences of the cancer itself on my face, and every time it reoccurs, I just go tanning, and it goes away. So basically, the only treatment that worked is tanning, and thank you for the opportunity to let me share my story.
Thank you so much for coming. Questions? All right. And Mother doesn't want to speak?
She was here mainly to answer questions. She's the
questions. Okay. All right. Thank you.
I do want to say one thing, Madam Chair.
And say your name for the record.
Julie Evans. if it weren't for us kind of taking matters into our own hands and going to TAN, she would have been undergoing years of different kinds of treatments, surgeries possibly. And if we would have been denied that access, I would have found a way to find one to see if that was actually something that would help her. In the back of my mind, I had a feeling it would help her. I don't know why, but I'm incredibly thankful that we had that access to be able to attain that. Otherwise, we'd be in a whole different situation, and it wouldn't be probably a really great one.
Thank you. Appreciate Thanks. It. All right. We have four more people. Jack Clevenger, Mandy Hendrickson, and Jana Jarvis. And then we'll end up with Oregon Health Authority. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jack Clevenger. I own Sun Station Tanning in State and Oregon. I'm probably your smallest tanning salon owner around. I have like six tanning beds. I came here to testify. Everybody's already kind of said reiterated all the regulations that we have are in place to protect the people. You've got the statutes. I don't probably need to read them. The statutes on the parents have to come in and sign to be able to tan for the minor. We have the statute with the warning statement is very explicit. It's the two statutes we have when they sign on the card, and it says everything about cancer. All the warnings and implications, it's on every tanning salon card. And I actually emailed you guys all a letter. It should be, you guys should already have it. But I guess as a parent, I'm concerned. Those are my concerns as a tanning salon owner. But as a parent, it's you're taking away one of my parental rights to decide whether or not it is for my child's interest or my, you know, as a parent and a child to sit and talk about whether or not we should be able to tan, and they should be able to tan. And I guess under, I don't know if you guys, I'm sure you guys all know. Sorry, I'm nervous.
You're doing great.
I'm great.
Don't worry about it. We don't
bite. I guess I want to get on a touchy subject I was told probably not to bring up, but under Oregon's current law, any teen, 15 to 17, they can have an abortion without any parental consent or knowledge. My daughter can have an abortion at 16 years old and can go have an abortion without even telling me. The way the law reads, and it was reaffirmed in 2006 with the Oregon ballot measure 43. It was the Teen Abortion Notification Initiative. It was defeated by the voters, stating what it's implying is that your 15-year-old daughter is old enough and mature enough to make a life-changing decision on their own without consenting with your parent. So I guess what I don't understand is, by law, they are old enough to do that, and they are not, at 15 years old, they're not old enough to decide with us parents whether or not it's their decision to tan. I'm concerned that we're becoming a nanny state. We're trying to govern everything. The implications, I guess, to back up a little bit, the implications with the physician's note, I guess. We're already overburdened with health care costs, and I don't know how much that's actually going to cost when you're having people going in and trying to get notes to tanning. I would hope that doctors have better things to do than to figure out when, if the ban goes into place, what's going to happen when teenage girls or boys are trying to figure out a way to get a tanning note. So it's just going to take more of their time. So I guess in closing, there's the much larger issue here at work. The purpose of our government has never been, nor should be, to protect individuals from themselves. America was founded on personal liberties and individual responsibility, not on government regulation. So I do ask you consider a no vote on this. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mandy Henriksen. I'm an area manager, director of operations for a 12-salon chain, Palm Beach Tan franchise that operates in Oregon and Vancouver, Washington. I wanted to thank the committee today for giving me the opportunity to speak. As a member of Smart Tan and a Smart Tan instructor myself, we've already always prided ourselves on our level of professionalism and the way we conduct our business, from the operation of our salons to skin typing our clients to restricting their exposure time to negate the risk of overexposure, to requiring those clients we have under 18 to have parental consent, consent that must be given in person at time of our salon. I've actually included a copy of our training program materials that we give you for your review so that you can review them at your leisure. It gives you an idea of what all of our operators have to go through prior to operating a tanning bed, prior to operating any of our salons or working any of our salons. We support these regulations. These regulations increase professionalism, and more importantly, they increase public education, knowledge, and safety. The state of Oregon currently has very aggressive regulations of the tanning industry. We are required to maintain and operate our equipment and facilities in accordance to these regulations. We are required to train all of our employees to a certified training program that educates them on UV, skin typing, risks, and smart tanning procedures. We are required to skin type all customers, dictate their tanning time and frequency in accordance with their skin type and recommended exposure schedule. We are required to inform and educate all of our customers on the importance of controlling their exposure and duration, the risks of overexposure. We are required to confirm that customers are using protective eyewear. And as I stated before, we are required to get parental consent in person for any customers under the age of 18. We ask for ID for any new customers. I don't care how young or old you look, we ask for ID. We ask for this ID prior to inserting them. We also ask for ID from the consenting parent. It's very important to confirm parentage as well, so we make sure we're getting the correct consent. These regulations help us promote and educate the public on safety and smart tanning procedures. I also come to you as a parent. I actually have three teenagers, two of them girls. I'm very concerned that my rights to make these decisions about activities in which my children partake is being taken away from me. My children's well-being, both now and in the future, is of the utmost importance to me. I'm a well-informed individual, and I weigh the risks and benefits in all the decisions I make for my kids. And I hope that I educate them so they can make their own decisions when they're older in a correct fashion. If I ban them from anything, they're not going to have that conversation with me to create that educational opportunity for them to make informed decisions when they're older. I support our current regulations that require parental consent for under 18. That gives me and other parents the right to weigh risks associated with UV exposure, the opportunity to educate my children, and the right to make a choice. It also gives me the opportunity to discuss with them the UV exposure that they actually get outside for the 3 to 6 months of the year that the sun actually, and I say actually, occasionally shines here in Oregon. I want to educate our children. I am very concerned that a ban will drive young people into an unregulated environment, very concerned. And an unregulated environment is any environment that does not give them the benefit of a trained operator to guide them and educate them and the conversation with a parent, whether that be outside at a track meet for 8 hours or one of my daughters deciding that she's going to go hang out with her friends at Savvy Island and just tan outside for 8 or 9 hours. I don't advocate that without a conversation. As a parent and operator, I would support an under 16 ban. Young adults prior to 16 have a more controlled environment already. 16-year-olds have a lot more freedom. They can drive. This gives them access to an uncontrolled tanning environment, whether it be outdoors, friends' houses, even driving across the bridge to tan in Washington, which is an unregulated state. Requiring parental consent would afford me the ability to have a discussion and make a decision. In fact, the state of Oregon trusts me as a parent to teach my 16-year-olds how to drive and advise them appropriately on making driving decisions that could impact many people, not just their own health in a tanning bed. I feel that a tanning ban that mimics out of the driving age and policy, that actually makes sense. It's very important in my eyes, and far more important than a ban, to create a comprehensive educational campaign and program that would teach youth how to responsibly take part in any activity that they will do, either indoors or out, regardless of whether or not you ban them. Sunshine Outdoors is free, unlimited, and uncontrolled. I truly hope this committee supports our efforts to work together to better manage our current regulations. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jana Jarvis here today on behalf of the American Sun Tanning Association. I recognize the very late hour and all that you have listened to, and so I will be as brief as possible. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about an issue today that everyone agrees is complex. In fact, even the medical community doesn't agree on this particular issue. And you heard some of that from Peter earlier. I have included in my packet of information for you some of the articles that were referenced in that and some of the diagrams that were referenced in that. And I think what the issue out of that is the fact that the lack of vitamin D is equally a serious health issue and can lead to a number of health concerns, including cancer. However, regardless of all of that, House Bill 2896 brings additional risk to this debate. Bans are rarely effective. Many issues, other than health issues, are evidence of this. And the industry, as you have heard here today, strongly believes in the parental consent standard that's being adopted in many other states now as we speak. You've heard today several times that, you know, 33 or 27 or however many states are proposing legislation. Many of the states are rejecting doing anything on this issue, and others are going towards the parental consent standard that has been in Oregon since the early 90s. But we are willing to bring more to the debate, and that's why you have those dash 3, dash 4, and dash 5 amendments before you today. And I just touch on them very briefly. The first, the dash 3, establishes a task force. And the reason for that is because the industry, the American sun tanning industry and members of the industry want to be engaged in this conversation in the future. And I think this gives us an opportunity to do that in the interim and address that. The dash 4s change the standard from under 18 to under 16. And the dash 5s add additional responsibilities to the parental consent standard. Currently, there's no, what Mandy referenced in terms of requiring ID is a company protocol, but it isn't the standard in the state. So with that, I want to just reiterate that the American Sun Tanning Association believes in a regulated industry with standards and protocols. And we would like to be part of the discussion. We would like to have been part of the discussion. You heard today that we had plenty of time because we had 2 weeks. And this is an industry that was not represented prior to session. And so we've been, to some extent, trying to come to the table as constructively as possible. We want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And thank you for your time and would welcome your questions.
Okay. Questions? All right. Thank you very much. And finally, David Leland, Oregon Health Authority.
Madam Chair, while David's coming up, I don't know what your intention is on this, but since this is really the first time I've had a chance to dive into this issue, I'd prefer if we not move this bill today so that I can give this a little more consideration.
And there are some things I want to follow up with the proponents of the bills since we now have additional information from the opposition. So we will not be moving the bill today. Okay.
Thank you. Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, I'm Dave Leland. I'm the interim administrator for the Center for Health Protection at the Public Health Division. I'm here to testify in support of the House bill. You've heard a lot about the health effects, so I'll move right to the regulatory program over tanning facilities, which is located in our shop in the Radiation Protection Services program. Facilities are inspected every 3 years for compliance with the rules, and as you've heard, the commercial tanning facilities are required to obtain the one-time written parental consent for minors to tan. However, we want to note that the operators are not required to ask the tanner's age or to verify proof of age, so there is that issue. We also require tanning operators to be formally trained, and that training includes how to properly skin type clients to ensure adherence to a tanning time schedule as provided by the device manufacturer. So here's just a couple of statistics from the inspection part of the program. In 2012, the most commonly cited violation by our inspectors was failure to properly skin type new tanners and failure to limit exposure to manufacturers' recommendations. In fact, over 50% of the salons inspected last year were cited for this. The third most common cited violation was inability of tanning operators to provide the proof of the approved training. And in 2012, 98 out of 192 salons inspected were cited for this. And I know that because I signed the civil penalty notices when it comes to that come across my desk. Really, given the risks presented by indoor tanning, we believe minors need the added protection proposed by the bill. If it's signed into law, we will adopt the necessary administrative requirements, including proof and documentation of age, signage, record keeping, and enforcement protocols. So we would be pleased to provide the committee with any additional information you need, and thank you for the opportunity to present.
Thank you. Yes.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah.
No, wait. I'm asking Senator Steiner Hayward to talk.
Oh, no, I didn't know if Senator Cruz wanted to.
I didn't see him. I saw you first.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm just very confused. Will we have an opportunity to ask some of the medical experts again about some of the vitamin D issues, or what would you prefer to have? How would you prefer to handle that? Because that's one of my
questions. This is why I don't want to move the bill yet. There's some information, I think, that we need that's been brought up in this testimony.
So
and
can
we could ask now, but I don't know if you're prepared to respond to some of the questions. We can tell... ask some of the questions now.
Could I perhaps ask Dr. Drucker as a cancer expert? Because some of the issues that have been brought up has been a question about the role of vitamin D in cancer protection, and I wonder if he might offer some insight. It may not be definitive, but I wonder if it would be okay to ask him.
Absolutely.
I need a question here, though, first. What's the penalty for violation?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz. On my interim gig here of the civil penalties that I've signed has been anywhere from several hundred to several thousands of dollars.
I mean, is there a matrix? I mean.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a fee. There's a penalty schedule in our administrative.
Get that for us, please. I think that would be helpful.
Would be delighted. Okay. Absolutely.
Thank you. Just send it to Sandy. She can get it to the rest of us.
We'll do that.
Any other questions?
That was
all right. Dr. Drucker, do you want to come up? Or yes, and Dr. Pierce.
I think Bud wants to come too. So.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, I'm going to have to leave in just a couple
yes,
minutes.
Yes, and I have a town hall, so yeah. I may turn it over to you.
I have a meeting too, but yeah. Hopefully we can.
This is very important. Okay.
May I?
Yes,
would you
please.
Prefer to, Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
Thank you. We heard some confusing testimony about the issues around vitamin D, and I have to say that this is a subject somewhat near and dear to my heart. As many people here know, I have multiple sclerosis, which is an autoimmune disorder, and vitamin D insufficiency can certainly contribute to that. But when I talk with my neurologist about this, he says that oral vitamin D3 is the best way to do it. It's inexpensive. You can take it consistently. You get a consistent dose. And he doesn't recommend doing it. And I know from personal experience that, you know, because I have my levels checked regularly as part of my medical treatment, that even being out in the sun a lot doesn't necessarily get me the exposure, the amount of vitamin D that I need. So... And I guess I'm a little confused because there have been some Institute of Medicine reports that talk about whether vitamin D really does play a role in cancer. I have a lot of confusion at this point, and I wonder what your thoughts are about this issue on vitamin D and cancer and the best way to get adequate vitamin D levels.
Well, Senator Hayward, thank you. I think you've accurately summarized the state of the field. There is not a consensus on the role of vitamin D in cancer. It has been used as a therapeutic. It has been used in some prevention studies, but there's not clarity on either its role in therapy or its role in prevention. What is clear is that vitamin D deficiency is common. What is also clear is that, as you have stated, vitamin D3 supplementation is the simplest, safest way to supplement. What is not clear is whether supplementing people who are not deficient will lead to any health benefits. That is where the Institute of Medicine report was questioning the recommendation of routine supplementation in people who are not known to be deficient. So I question whether there are clear health benefits of supplemental vitamin D, either as a therapeutic or as a prevention. More studies need to be done. There's not a definitive answer.
But clearly, if one is going to supplement, follow up, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, if one's going to supplement on doctor's recommendation based on levels, it's safer to do it with oral medication.
The safest, most effective is with oral supplementation,
okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Steiner, Haywood. I was
just repeat here. Your name
oh,
for the
Bud
record.
Pierce, Oregon Medical Association President and medical oncologist in Salem, Oregon. Reading an article, a little bit from Oslo, Norway, interesting. Vitamin D is exclusively generated by UVB, while UVA and UVB likely play a role in the onset of cutaneous malignant melanoma. There's no debate in the medical literature that exposure to UV radiation leads to premature skin aging. and non-melanoma skin cancers. It's a direct relationship. You can do mouse studies, and there's no debate. There has been some debate about the exposure and the risk of cutaneous malignant melanoma. Interestingly, as researchers have pointed out, UVB sunlight leads to the formation of vitamin D. There's some interest in indoor workers that what happens is the glass screens out the UV. When the UV comes through the window, it screens out the UVB, and they get exposed to UVA, and that may degrade the vitamin D that's in their skin. So again, another mechanism that all UV isn't the same. There's no evidence that UVA is going to raise your vitamin D levels, and that UVB and ultraviolet B is actually the agent that does that. Also, these vitamin D studies that you see where there are very low levels, you're primarily measuring low levels in inner city people, poor people, people of color, people that aren't going to respond a lot of times to even sunlight to get more vitamin D, because when you're darkly pigmented, you don't produce vitamin D from sunlight. And a lot of old elderly people, they lack enzymes in their skin to do that. And it's the industry is targeting the group that has generally high vitamin D levels. You're talking about affluent young, Caucasian girls. And so again, this idea that number one, there's no evidence to increase the production of vitamin D by doing UVA tanning, and number two, we're not actually moving towards some health benefit in the people that actually supposedly need health benefit, even if the agent would help, which it doesn't. Talking about carcinogens, alcohol is a potent carcinogen. Alcohol causes head and neck cancer. Can lead to increased bladder cancer. It can lead to women who have a high risk of breast cancer. We counsel them against drinking alcohol. So to poo-poo the World Health Organization say that, well, a glass of Pinot Noir doesn't cause trouble. Yeah, I agree, a glass of Pinot Noir doesn't cause trouble, probably, although if you're susceptible, the alcohol in there may. So again, it's easy to denigrate people who sit there and look at a study dispassion and just say it does or it doesn't. You know, it does or it doesn't. So again, a little medical controversy about the negative aspects of UV exposure, aging, one-to-one correlation with squamous cell cancer, basal cell cancer. Little murky on melanoma, although certainly the weight of the evidence is sufficient to recommend that for children who do not have judgment that adults have, I suggest that the children, when they're 18, sit down with their parents and they can have the discussion at that time if they want to be exposed to tanning beds. But I think for 16 and 17-year-olds, as responsible citizens of this society, we should say no.
Thank you.
Sounds like Dr. Pierce is saying stay away from Pinot Noir, but Chablis probably okay.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. Thank you so very much. Any more questions?
Just really quickly, you brought this issue about the tanning device thing. Is that language, does anybody know, is that language that we got from Legislative Council, and has Legislative Council given us an opinion?
This is what I wanted to do, and I have to be in the City of Fairview for a town hall at 7, but this is what I want to talk about with
the speed limit to get
with the proponents of the bill. And so tomorrow would be the best time to talk to me, and then I will be talking with the opponents, the lobbyists of the opponents also, to let them know what my intent is. But at this point, we need some clarification. And thank you so very much for spending all of this time, all of you, opponents and proponents. This is a public hearing, and this is what we need to do before we can make a policy decision. With that, I would like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2896, and we are adjourned. Thank you.